This weekend starts right after this.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Why ships keep crashing? I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koshenka. First full weekend of April. Glad you could be with us, and here's what's coming up this hour.
Incidents like the massive container vessel stuck in the Suez Canal are more common than you think. The Atlantic has a look at shipping issues.
On the medical front, the benefits of at least a little bit of stress.
The 82-year-old woman who's become an internet sensation for her Sunday church outfits.
And the travel vouchers that may prove worthless.
Well, they've always given out vouchers if you cancel your flight on a non-refundable ticket. With the start of the pandemic, they waived change fees, which they've since dropped. And they also extended voucher expiration. Generally, you have 1 year from the day you purchase the ticket. So those deadlines were coming up pretty short.
Scott McCartney at the Wall Street Journal on the Catch-22 with soon-to-expire credits. Well, when a big jet airplane crashes, it almost always makes headlines around the world, and for good reason. Fatal passenger accidents are extremely rare. This past week, though, the eyes of the world were on the massive container ship that got lodged between the banks of the Suez Canal and was then freed after 6 days. David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic, says the predicament of the ship, named Ever Given, is both highly unusual and typical. David, explain that.
Well, you don't usually see a case like this that captures so much attention and that blocks world commerce in the way that this ship has. But big ships like this have accidents all the time. We're at a rate of almost one a week in the last couple of years. And if you look over the last decade, you've got almost twice a week, about 100 a year, you have major ships that have there are a total loss for some reason.
Boy. So these one per week accidents, roughly, what's happening with them? Ships banging into each other, or getting stuck, or running aground?
All of the above. You get all that sort of stuff. And it's mostly those sort of issues. A ship runs aground, it breaks up on rocks, it has an incident port. You don't usually have ships that sort of sink and disappear in the way that we think of historically, although that does happen as well. But it's a whole range of losses.
Wow. So you referenced in here that shipping has tried to take some lessons from aviation, and it either has not done it effectively or chosen to go a different route. To explain that.
Yeah, in the 70s and 80s, after a series of accidents, the airline industry and the aviation industry realized they had something wrong and needed to redesign the way they did processes. And they introduced something called cockpit resource management, now usually called crew resource management, which basically is a way of making sure that everybody's communicating and there's the whole team is being drawn, and it's not just a captain ordering people around, sometimes taking advice, and sometimes missing important signals. That kind of culture of deference seemed to be involved in a lot of these crashes. And the result is the aviation industry is incredibly safe. We have so few passenger airline crashes in the U.S. and really very few around the world. In the shipping industry, they adopted some of those principles for something called bridge resource management. But it's not as complete, and it hasn't been as effective, and it hasn't kept up to date. And the result is you have a marine industry that is loses these boats so frequently, really in stark comparison to aviation.
Is that because shipping is not held to the same accountability as aviation because there just are not ordinary passengers traveling on a container ship?
I think that's a big part of it. There aren't when dozens of people die, that gets a lot of public attention. Whereas if a ship disappears and a few sailors die, it's not noticed as much. I think it's especially true when you get foreign ships without Americans on them.
Yeah,
and the other thing is there's just not a centralized body to oversee in the same way that aviation is. It's a much less regulated industry.
Well, we're speaking with David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic. He's got a story called Why Ships Keep Crashing. So how about some takeaways from here? Anybody say that this will serve as some sort of wake-up call?
Well, one might hope. There's so much attention on this, and I think that it would be a good time for people to pay attention to it. But it also, I think there's a risk that it's sort of a novelty story and it goes back to being in the background. But maybe people are more aware, both because of this and because of the pandemic, about supply lines and about how the shipping industry affects their lives, and there will be a little bit more interest in making sure that it's protected and that the industry is taking up good standards.
I don't pretend to know, but is there some sort of a level of difficulty difference in, say, operating a plane versus a ship?
I mean, I think they're different beasts in a lot of ways. Planes are very complicated, obviously. They're incredible machinery, and boats are a relatively simple technology by comparison. But you think about the cockpit of a plane, you've got all the controls up there. And I talked to a captain who said, you know, on the boat, if you have a problem in the engine room, you've got to go, you got to call down to the engine room. Maybe you got to go down there. It's a long walk to the engine room. So there's all these things that haven't modernized, even as these ships have gotten so huge, like the Ever Given.
Mm. You referenced, too, that there are language barriers sometimes.
That's right. I mean, ship crews are incredibly multinational. Often you'll get, officers from one country or a few countries and crew from another one. And so while there's a, you know, English is a common language for the most part, it's not spoken by everybody on the ship in the way that is required for international flights and for domestic flights.
Thanks, David. David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic. Coming up next, when stress can be good for you. When you call a Dell Technologies advisor, you're talking to someone who isn't waiting for their turn to speak, but who actually wants to hear what you have to say. They're focused on you, ready to give advice on everything from laptops to the cloud, and offer tailored solutions powered by Intel vPro platform to keep your small business ready for what's next. Our advisors listen, so you know your small business needs have been heard. Call a Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Ask Dell. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Too much stress can be bad for your health, you know that. But is there an amount of stress that can actually be beneficial? In-depth analysis from Lee Richardson, licensed professional counselor and founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. Lee, how do you see it?
Well, you know, Gordon, I've thought about it. Sometimes when I'm most excited about something happening to me or that I'm going to participate in, I do get stressed. And it's kind of a positive stress.
And that's different, say, chemically from bad stress. How?
Well, I think that stress releases neurotransmitters in your brain and epinephrine. And I think that anytime you're releasing neurotransmitters, that's good for your brain and for your body. But bad stress, I mean, stress is a normal, healthy reaction to what's going on around us. And our body is equipped to handle low levels of stress. It's just when I think we hit above the norm, and with the last year, stress has been going on for about a year.
Does it often come down to how we personally manage what we feel is stress? Because stress to one person may not be stress to another, I guess.
Absolutely. It's how we react to it. I think that makes all the difference in the world, because on some days when everything's going your way and life is good and somebody cuts you off, it's like, what a jerk, haha. On a day when everything's going bad and you feel like you haven't had one positive thing happen all day and somebody cuts you off, you hit that horn, you let those four-letter words fly, you react very differently.
Yeah. It is some of this the old fight or flight when it
Absolutely.
Comes to, and the reaction, I guess.
Yeah, because when you get when that sympathetic takes over and that autonomic nervous system, which is probably too much information, but when that happens, you get into that fight or flight mode, and it's not something you can control. It's your body. Some people may get nauseous. Some people may their heart maybe start beating really, really fast. It's a natural biological reaction.
Can those things happen, Lee, whether it's good stress or bad stress?
I think when it's good stress, then we're not worried about it. We're just, oh, I'm excited. Oh, I'm a little stressed. And when it's bad stress, we react to it differently. I'm not going to be able to deal with this. I'm not going to be able to get through the day. Hmm. So you hit the nail on the head. It's how you manage it, how you react to it.
We're speaking with Lee Richardson, licensed professional counselor, also founder of the Brain Performance Center based in Dallas. We're talking about whether some stress can be good for you. How about folks who claim they feel no stress at all?
Well, I read this study that said that people that have no stress, they're healthier and their moods are better. However, on a cognitive level, they perform differently. And I think that people with no stress probably engage in life a little bit differently. I mean, most of the people in that study, they were older, they were male, they were unmarried, they were less likely to work, had little emotional support, no really positive daily events going on in their life. So I think they were in the parasympathetic state. And that is, you know, where you're just kind of rocking along, not making waves. Because stress is a part of everyday life. And I think it's really rare to not react to something in your life.
Yeah. Is it possible some of those folks are in stress denial? Like, do we sometimes say, I don't feel stress?
Could be. Or just in kind of that numb state, you know, where you just kind of go through and just, everything, I'm okay, you're okay, I've got food on the table, I've got a roof over my head, I'm okay.
Yeah.
You know, it's what your expectations for life are, too. Some of the clients that come in that are the most stressed out, it's because they set these unrealistic expectations on what they can achieve. And that does create a huge amount of stress.
Thanks, Lee. Lee Richardson, founder of the Brain Performance Center, also author of a book called Turn Your Brain On to Get Your Game On. Travelers right now find themselves in a catch-22 with soon-to-expire credits. More from this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
There's a big problem facing travelers. Billions of dollars worth of vouchers and credits will soon expire, but many people don't yet feel comfortable about flying. If you're in this situation, what can you do? Scott McCartney, middle seat columnist for the Wall Street Journal, is here with some tips. Scott, when did airlines start giving out the vouchers, and when are they expiring?
Well, they've always given out vouchers if you cancel your flight on a non-refundable ticket. They, with the start of the pandemic, they waived change fees, which they've since dropped. And they also extended voucher expiration. Generally, you have 1 year from the day you purchase the ticket. So those deadlines were coming up pretty short. And a lot of airlines extended out to December 31st of this year. But not all. Delta actually had a pretty short extension, and it was only applied to tickets purchased before April 17th. So last April, if you bought a ticket at the end of April on Delta and then couldn't travel, you only have 1 year, and so those vouchers are going to expire pretty soon. Southwest is a similar situation. Their date was September 7th. So it's tricky, it's complicated, but airlines acknowledge there's four largest airlines have $10 billion of vouchers sitting out there. And United said in a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission that it thought a significant portion of that may expire unused.
Do the airlines then basically make money for doing nothing if you don't use your vouchers?
Yeah, I mean, this is it's a little bit like getting a gift card and paying for a gift card and losing it. Yes, the airlines pocket, they use a retailing term. They call it breakage. It is straight to the bottom line for airlines.
Scott, can you do anything to negotiate with your airline if yours are running out?
You can. Anecdotally, we've heard some airlines are more willing to provide leniency than others. American just yesterday decided it was going to extend out from December 31st to March 31st of next year to give people more flexibility. I think it is worthwhile to call, to beg, to explain that, in many cases, you bought a ticket for a trip to Paris, an American tourist can't go to Paris right now, and we don't know when we'll be able to do that. A lot of people aren't going to be able to, or certainly won't feel comfortable traveling overseas this year.
We're speaking with Scott McCartney of the Wall Street Journal. Scott, we've been seeing some numbers that people are starting to fly again. Are people starting to use their vouchers?
They are, and they should. But the numbers are still small, relative to the amount that's out there. You know, if you think about it, there is a year's worth of travel that was wiped out. And in some cases, if the airline canceled the flight before you canceled your reservation, you were entitled to the option of a refund. Now, not all airlines abided by that, but for the most part, people ended up with vouchers and they need to use them.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal travel columnist Scott McCartney. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. In the sport of business, we're all players. And with the game always changing, you need to be versatile. So does your wardrobe. You want both style and comfort to look as good as you feel inside the office or out. That's what Cuts Clothing is all about. Cuts Clothing keeps you sharp wherever the game takes you, from the boardroom to the bar to the gym. How? They reinvented men's clothing, starting with the T-shirt. Their Pika Tri-Blend fabric is buttery soft, wrinkle-free, and keeps its shape. Everything I've worn from Cuts is next-level comfort. Their polos, hoodies, and crew sweatshirts, all classics, made modern with custom-engineered fabrics you have to wear to believe. So versatile, you'll never need to take them off, and so comfortable, you won't want to. It's not just the lifestyle. It's not just clothing. It's office leisure apparel for the sport of business. Get 15% off your first order by going to cutsclothing.com/Gordon. That's cutsclothing.com/Gordon for 15% off the only shirt worth wearing. People lose their tempers all of the time, but now that almost every Uber and taxi has cameras, you're on stage pretty much 24/7. Everyone effectively has a camera. Your opportunity for freedom and a job-ending event is therefore far more likely. Rob Enderle, founder of the tech firm The Enderle Group, says Disney has a specific rule that everyone should take to heart. Rob, your experience.
Well, so we're just kind of wrapping our heads around the idea that you're always on camera. Everybody has a smartphone. And if you do something bad, at least when I was a kid, if you did something bad, pretty good chance if somebody saw you, it wasn't like they could put you on the internet because it didn't exist. But now, if you behave badly, you can become a YouTube sensation, and not in a good way, and lose your job, if not your entire career, if you act out. And that just reminded me of something when I worked for Disneyland years ago. They had a concept. Believe it or not, there's actually an academy you go to work at the park. But one of the things they really drill into you is this idea of being on stage versus off stage. And the one thing that would get you terminated pretty quickly was if, when you're on stage in costume, if you behave badly. And we had a lot of events at the park that you would think would drive people to behave badly. One is a lot of the customers of the parks are pretty abusive. We actually had one character, I think it was one of the Three Little Pigs, that a guy came up with a knife and started stabbing with the knife. And in that costume, you know, you can't move very well. So he's in the costume looking down. He sees the knife coming into the costume. It wasn't hitting him, but it certainly freaked the guy out quite a bit. And then we had another case where an Asian family came in with a bunch of kids, and they decided to see, clearly been studying martial arts, if they could drop kick the dwarfs. And that, once again, you're in a costume, you can't move well. And every time one of the dwarfs stood up, they'd be knocked back down again. And in the defense of the kids that were doing this, they were convinced these were cartoons, and they could, because in cartoons you can do anything to a cartoon without killing them hurting them. Yeah. The same rules applied, but as we know, when you're in a costume, getting stabbed, shot, or kicked, or whatever is going to hurt. But in all cases, you were supposed to behave very well, never strike the customer back in your costume, not much you could do anyway. But never badmouth, never cuss, never curse. In other words, when you're on stage, you are aware you're on stage, you're in costume, and you stay in character. And that's what we have to learn now, because we are all of us now pretty much on stage all the time, often even when we're in our homes now. It used to be you'd be concerned when you're outside, but a lot of us have Echo devices in our houses. They have cameras. Increasingly, they have cameras. The show devices have cameras, and they capture you as well doing stuff if you're not careful. So the concept is as long as you behave like you're on stage, behave like you've got people watching, then you won't be the embarrassment and you won't do career damage like a lot of folks do. The thing that really triggered this was the Gina Carano thing.
Yeah.
On Twitter, where she tweeted something inappropriate, and Disney booted her out of the entire Star Wars franchise, which was a very lucrative gig, mm-hmm. and the and certainly cost her a great deal, and we've got recurring memes on Karen's. It's kind of sad. My niece's name is Karen, so every time they bring this up, she kind of cringes. But on women that were misbehaving against minorities, and of course now we've got a big problem with people attacking Asians. Increasingly, that's caught on camera as well, and the end result, of course, is those folks are ending up, as they should, prosecuted and in jail. So the point is, once you act like you're always on camera, you behave like you're always on camera, then you won't have these problems. You won't become infamous, and you won't suddenly find, you know, yourself kicked out of college, kicked out of school, kicked out of your job, and unemployable.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, principal and founder of The Enderle Group. Coming up next, a new look at our shopping habits.
Innovation. Resilience. Agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Americans have tracked the progress of the coronavirus pandemic by watching case counts, right? Or positivity rates. But you also could have watched your shopping carts and Amazon Prime orders. Leslie Albrecht, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch, has a look at consumer spending data. Leslie, what are we learning?
If you looked at your shopping habits over the last year, you would have seen the story of the pandemic unfolding in your shopping cart, okay? Because people stopped going out, as we know, and they stopped spending on things like going to the movies, going to sports games, concerts, and things like that. And all told, Americans spend about $500 billion a year on those sort of experience-based purchases. When we stopped spending that money, we had money to spend on other things, such as actual material possessions, and we've been doing that. We've been buying a lot of stuff. And what's really interesting is that people at the low end of the economic spectrum and at the higher end are all spending money in different ways during the pandemic.
Yeah. You referenced some unusual cheese. Like, why would that pop up?
Yeah, so, okay, this is a classic example of how not everyone has had the financial setbacks that a lot of people have had during the pandemic. You know, as we know, a lot of people have lost their jobs, but other people are thriving financially, and those people have disposable income, and they are bored and stuck at home, and they want to recreate the experience of going out to a nice restaurant. So they've been doing stuff like buying blue cheese, Parmesan Reggiano, other specialty cheeses, so that they can recreate kind of a restaurant-type meal at home.
How about that? What about on the lower end of the financial spectrum, maybe those families who lost significant income?
So meanwhile, while some folks are buying specialty cheeses, folks at the other end of the spectrum are buying kidney beans in huge numbers. That kidney bean sales had been down in the 52 weeks before the pandemic started. This year, they've soared. And that has to do with people looking for cheap sources of protein. People who've been laid off from their jobs don't have as much money to spend at the grocery store, so they're looking for those inexpensive ways to get themselves fed.
Wow. I'm speaking with Leslie Albrecht, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. Her story is called More Kidney Beans and Less Cold Medicine, How COVID-19 Rewrote American Shopping Lists. Touch on that other part of the headline with regards to less cold and flu medicine.
Yeah, this part is so interesting. So during the pandemic, we've been spending a lot on buying oranges, okay? Sales of oranges were down before the pandemic, but people started buying them in droves. Why? Because they were hoping to boost their immune system with vitamin C. But guess what? It turned out we didn't really need to do that. We haven't been getting sick, with the obvious exception of people getting COVID, but we haven't been getting colds and flus. And so what that resulted in is that there's been a huge drop in the sales of cold and flu medicine. And that's because, you know, people are socially distancing, they're wearing masks, and they're not getting flu.
That's remarkable. Air purifiers, too? Vacuum cleaners?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, so this is kind of, this is sort of sad, I guess. One of the things, so here's how we've been spending our extra time. You know, we've been spending our money differently. We've also been spending our time differently. The number one things that people have been doing with their extra time, one is they've been watching more TV, but then they've also been cleaning more and cooking more. So it's kind of like drudgery, household drudgery, followed by, like, relax, Netflix and chill.
Thanks, Leslie. Leslie Albrecht, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. Coming up next, cicadas. Billions of cicadas. When you call a Dell Technologies advisor, you're talking to someone who isn't waiting for their turn to speak, but who actually wants to hear what you have to say. They're focused on you, ready to give advice on everything from laptops to the cloud, and offer tailored solutions powered by Intel vPro platform to keep your small business ready for what's next. Our advisors listen, so you know your small business needs have been heard. Call a Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL.
Hey, glad you're with us. Americans are excitedly planning outdoor weddings and other events after a long hibernation during the pandemic, only to run into billions of cicadas that are expected to crawl out of the ground across the eastern U.S. at the same time. Scott Calvert, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, says that has some seeking the help of experts as they bug out over whether hordes of the flying red-eyed insects will ruin everything. Scott, what's ahead?
Yeah, well, first of all, it might be good to just do a quick little lesson on cicadas. You know, there are different kinds of cicadas. So you've got the annual cicadas, which people see pretty much every year, usually starting around late June. But then totally separate from that, you've got these periodical cicadas. And they're amazing. They live in the ground for either 13 or 17 years, and then they emerge in huge numbers. And each of those groups is called a brood. And this year, it's the turn of brood 10, looks like brood X because they use Roman numerals, kind of gives an ominous feel to it. And brood 10 is one of the largest of the periodical broods. So every 17 years, these guys emerge. So last time was 2004. This time, they'll be emerging by the billions starting in May once the soil temperature reaches about 64 degrees. And they will come out. And they'll shed this little nymph skin that looks like a sort of a brown shell that you see. And then they start heading up trees and other vertical objects. And the goal, once they get up there, is to basically mate, right? So there's this frenzy of mating. The males serenade the females, and they're really loud, like jackhammer level. And once the mating happens and the females lay their eggs in tree branches, all the cicadas die. And then eventually the little babies hatch and they fall to the ground, burrow into the soil for another 17 years.
Wow. So apropos of nothing, what is attractive to a female about a loudmouth male? Right?
Good question.
You bring up an interesting point about the cicadas because I feel like when stories like yours come up and I thought, 17 years? I just did this story not that long ago. It couldn't have been 17 years. So they kind of operate in, as you said, these different broods.
Right. So, I mean, in a given year, you're typically going to have a brood emerge somewhere. And these periodical cicadas only appear in the eastern part of the United States. So somewhere in the eastern U.S., most years, you're going to have one of these broods coming out. I said, brood 10 is sort of the biggest. It also, one of the biggest. It also covers a pretty broad swath. I mean, it's from parts of Georgia all the way up to New York, 15 states. Not all over all of those states. And in fact, it can be pretty patchy. I mean, one general rule of thumb is if you had them in 2004, you're likely to have them again unless there's been like a lot of development, you know, paving over the ground and such. And if you didn't, you probably won't because they don't travel very far.
Interesting. So are they destructive?
They're not really destructive. I mean, they can do some harm to young trees, but they actually have some beneficial qualities as well. I mean, first of all, they're a great food source for all kinds of animals. And if you have a dog or a cat that's outside, they're gonna snap up a few. And people eat them too, actually. Some of them. they supposedly taste like canned asparagus. Not that I've ever tried one myself. But they aerate the soil with their tunnels. And, you know, when they die, those are nutrients that go back into the ground, which are good for trees. So, you know, there's some positive qualities, and they really don't do much harm. But, boy, they can be pretty annoying.
Thanks, Scott. Scott Calvert, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, the 82-year-old blazing a fashion trail.
Innovation. Resilience. Agility. It's how Michigan businesses work together and continue to build the future. Our expertise, talented workforce, and collaborative environment are making a difference now and shaping the future. Join us and make your mark where it matters. Visit michiganbusiness.org/radio to put your plans in motion. That's michiganbusiness.org/radio.
Well, finally, it's been more than a year now that churchgoers have been watching virtual streaming Sunday services on their cell phones and computers during the pandemic. Many have made a habit of tuning in while wearing cozy sweatpants or pajamas. Then there's Laverne Ford Wimberly of Tulsa. The Washington Post says the 82-year-old retired educator decks herself out head to toe every Sunday. Then, to the delight of fellow parishioners at Metropolitan Baptist Church, posts a selfie on Facebook after the service. Since March of last year, she has taken photos of herself from her living room in 53 different color-coordinated outfits, satisfying her love of making a grand entrance since she was a young school teacher in the 1960s. She actually had to start writing down what she wore each week on a calendar this past year so that she wouldn't commit the faux pas of wearing the same outfit twice. Her love of fashion, by the way, has gone 180. The Post says when she was growing up, Ms. Wimberly said she cared more about climbing the tallest tree with the neighborhood boys than trying on the latest frilly arrivals at fashion stores in downtown Tulsa. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. GEICO.com. Easy.